This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Conserving heritage building retains not only bricks and mortar, but also the history, character, and identity of communities where people live, work, and recreate. Badan Warisan Malaysia has long been a champion for the conservation of Malaysia's built heritage and to develop an understanding of what that means as an expression of history and identity. I find out more about their work and projects for the year from Badan Warisan Malaysia's president, Elizabeth Cardoza, and communications manager, Melanie Anthony. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Thank you.
Firstly, what does Badan Warisan do, you know, on a day-to-day basis? What kind of work are you involved in?
Well, I think that, as you said, our main mission is really looking at the preservation and conservation of Malaysia's built, you know, and cultural heritage. So everything we do relates to that, you know, the building we're in, the kind of facilities that we have, any of the engagement that we do with the public really relates to awareness raising, documentation, research, from very sort of basic, hey, this is our heritage, to very, very technical work at, let's say, when we're restoring a building. So, you know, it's a full range. But, you know, maybe Melanie can talk to you about, you know, on a daily basis, what we do at our Heritage Centre in KL. We've got one in Malacca as well. But.
Well, in the one in KL, we run it as a heritage centre, and so people can come in on a daily basis. We've got a project there. It's called the Rumah Penghulu Abu Saman, and we do guided tours. So anyone can just walk in, or they can even do bookings with us, and we do curated programs for them to understand the house, to study it, to explore the culture of the Malaysian lifestyle. Other than that, we also do have a resource centre where basically a lot of students come in there to do their research. Even journalists come there and use it to explore the information that we have there. We've got books, we've got maps, we've got what else?
Photographs.
Journals, so any research that you want to do?
Cuttings, yeah. For, you know, over a period of. And it's a niche collection, I think, specifically related to Malaysia's built heritage. So it really is. And it's in the public domain. You know, it's not like with the university where you find it difficult to access. And it's very specific to our history and heritage.
It's quite easy, I think, to wander around KL and mindlessly not notice, I guess, where you are and see the heritage around you. How and why did you both get involved with Badan Warisan, and what interested you about heritage, about these causes?
By accident?
Mine was accident too.
Actually, I sort of, you know, I come from a cultural background, a performing arts background. And prior to joining Badan Warisan, which is about 15 years ago, I really was involved in various things to do with cultural management and programming and looking at cultural exchange and trying to raise, I suppose, the capacity of different people with, you know, working in that sphere. But this was really an interesting area, not so much new for me. I was sort of incidentally, you know, at various stages involved with Badan Warisan's work. But it was, when you, as KL progressed, as it developed, you know, more and more things got lost. Sort of, you know, and because I kind of didn't grow up directly in KL, but I had a lot of contact with KL in the years I was growing up. And you kind of like go like, oh, that's gone. And then, you know, as you kind of wander around and maybe 2 weeks later you say, oh, you know, where's that come from? You know, that kind of thing. And it really was more that sort of, you know, the tear, I would suppose, in my personal memory and my personal sort of visual landscape, you know, and historical landscape, that makes working in heritage really interesting, because it really is trying to piece together and to draw back those stories. But, you know, Melanie.
Well, mine was totally different. I mean, it was accidental, but I joined Badan Warisan about five years ago because we had a project in Penang. And I managed this place. It was a 200-year-old heritage building, and I never used to have passion for heritage. Actually, just like what Elizabeth said, I never really noticed old buildings. For me, it was a whole flashy, nice-looking, modern-looking buildings. But when I started doing this project with Badan Warisan in Penang, I sort of grew into it, kind of liked the whole heritage thing, and I developed a deeper sense of awareness and knowing how important these kind of buildings are. And then I moved back to KL 2 years ago. Yeah, and joined Badan Warisan here in KL. And my perspective of what heritage is right now is mostly, it's got not much to do with buildings, but more of the community, the sense of belonging to a city. So I had an issue with that when I first started, you know, where did I belong to? Because I'm originally from Seremban, but I never felt belong there. I felt more belonged in Penang, you know, so.
And now you're here.
And now I'm here, yeah.
So what, when Melanie first came, you know, it was like, you know, like this place, you know, this metropolis. And it was like, okay, why don't you go and explore, you know, but here are some maps and walk
oh,
around.
I did a lot of exploring.
And she did a lot of exploring. And as you walk and as you explore and as you read, and I think that the more you know and the more you sort of pause, you know, and take the time to look at something, you actually, these things, you discover. Mm. You discover things not just about the city, you know, but you also discover things about the people who made that city and who make the city. So the people who are there now, as you know, as well as the people who were there in the past. And that really is sort of, I suppose, you know, self-education, but, you know, it's that kind of thing that Badan Warisan really wants to, you know, get across. That this is not, heritage is not something in the past. Heritage is actually for the future.
And I think it's something that we want people to really understand where they belong. Because once you understand how, if you feel belong to a place, you feel the need to want to protect it, you know? So,
Elizabeth, earlier you talked about that feeling of, oh, where did that come from? Or, oh, where did that place go? And I think all KLites, anybody who lives in the Klang Valley, can still relate to that feeling. You know, you walk past something and it's gone. And the next day there's a new mall, seemingly overnight. So profit, I think, and future development, those are the things that often trump the idea of conservation and preservation of the past. I know where you land on that argument, but why do you think it's something that continues to be difficult to communicate? Why is it something that people, you know, continue to not prioritize?
Actually, that's really quite interesting because, you know, people who go abroad, who say, I want to travel and I want to see, and then they go to, what do? I go to Paris and I go and look at the Eiffel Tower, you know. And then it's like, actually, that is kind of like 100 and plus, you know, I mean, it was what, 1895 or something like that, right? If I remember correctly. And it's like, you know, very old structure, engineering feat, no doubt, you know. But you go and you look at these things, you look at historic houses, and then you come here and you kind of, it's your backyard, you know, and you kind of don't relate to it in the same way, you don't engage with it in the same way. And I think that part of it is because of the way we were educated, because of what we were brought up with. And what are our priorities? We're talking about ourselves as really a relatively young nation. I mean, we will be 60, right? In 2017, yeah. And it's young. And so, you know, what are the priorities of the nation? And our education system, you know, what does that tell us? You know, and what kind of dreams do we have? And so the past is something that we don't prioritize, except culture as a commodity. And that, I think, is what we try to fight against all the time, because culture is seen as a commodity. If I keep this building, it is because the tourists come. Well, what about the community who live around it? Aren't they kind of like more important? Because as the custodians, I mean, they own it, right?
Yeah, they're
so you're
year
kind
round.
Of like, you know, like they're the ones you really should be thinking about first. And then the tourists will come because that's where it's real. Rather than sort of as a monument, you know, under glass. Heritage under glass is really quite boring. Like, you can look at it on your screen, like, you know what I mean, in that sense. So I think that's sort of where, you know, I feel the argument kind of begins to fall down when you look at development, because unless you take a holistic approach, it doesn't mean you retain everything. But it does mean that before you do any development, you should actually consider what it is that was there. So there is very little, I think, understanding or mapping of the historical fabric, because it's all seen as an ad hoc basis. This is my lot. I can do whatever I want. And so rather than you standing at your boundary and looking out at what surrounds you, you stand at your boundary and you look in at what monument you can build for yourself. I think, and that really is where developers, you know, in my view, maybe, you know, could be a little bit more farsighted.
I'm speaking today with Elizabeth Cardoza, President of Badan Warisan Malaysia, and Melanie Anthony, Communications Manager. I'm also obviously at the same place because today we're talking about Badan Warisan Malaysia's work. Up next, we talk about how difficult it can be to conserve. Even if you do save a building from a wrecking ball, what happens next? You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me today, Badan Warisan Malaysia's President Elizabeth Cardoza and Communications Manager Melanie Anthony. They're both here today to talk about the work that they're doing. And we've been discussing kind of that push and pull between development and conservation. Now, even if you do successfully say, okay, this building is going to be conserved, this area is going to be conserved, the practice of building conservation requires a lot of, you know, professional involvement, a lot of expertise that not everybody would have. What can you tell us about this? What is required to conserve or preserve a building?
Well, I would say that the first thing you want to look at is you should maintain, you know, a new building, any building needs to be well maintained. You kind of look at that first. And if it has been well maintained, then there's very little conservation or preservation work that needs to be done. It really, you know, that, and that's the basic principle. I think part of it is the stigma of something old. Antiques, you know, objets, they can be appreciated because they are seen as having a value, you know, a commercial value, an antique value. But when it comes to a building, you know, if you have a two-story building on a 5,000 square foot piece of land, you know, it's considered, well, not very profitable, so you want to make it larger. But as you said, you know, assuming you can retain it or for whatever reason you're going to keep it, what do you need to do? You need to make sure it's in good nick, you know, keep the roof, the gutters clear, you know. And that doesn't require any specialist knowledge, really.
It common
just
sense.
Is common sense, right? If it is a dilapidated building and needs some work, yes, you do need to have some knowledge about what to do. A good contractor would usually know how to do that. But that then becomes a bit more tricky when you get into materials that are really very sort of like older. You can't, you know, you don't find the skills around anymore. And that's when you kind of, you know, start talking about restoring. But that usually sort of, you know, works more with monuments, you know, with big, beautiful, important structures. And at this point, you know, of time, we are restoring a mosque in Klang. We're involved in the restoration of a mosque in Klang. And it is very technical. There are parts of it which are very technical. But, you know, parts of it are, let's clean the building because actually it's quite kotola and has been cleaned for a long time. You know, there is a technique for cleaning, but it is not anything necessarily new, but it does require a certain amount of sensitivity. So you don't go in there and brashly treat. It's like, you know, you don't take your grandmother and say, run down that path, you know, that
you
kind
need
of thing.
Exercise, go.
You know, yeah, it's like, and I want you there in 10 seconds. You know, it doesn't work that way. You know, it's like, okay, let's take our time. Let's figure it out as we go along. And that really is a lot of conservation work is actually common sense. It's like thinking about it, research and understanding it. But that's sort of on the very, you know, very technical basis. But, you know, I mean, ask Melanie. She's been sort of dealing, she dealt with a 200-year-old house. It's like, and she's been dealing now with, you know, this Rumah Penghulu, you know, which is
a timber structure. Well, I just think it takes a lot of maintenance still. But, well, like what Elizabeth said, it doesn't really need high-end know-how, how to treat the building and things like that. When I was working in the management, the project that we did in Penang, it was not so much about just maintaining the building. It's also giving the respect that the building needs, how you treat it. You know, and we did a lot of activities there. So when we had all these activities, I normally say like, hey, you know, this is a building here and this is what you need to do. This is the kind of respect that you pay towards it. You know, you don't simply put things on the wall and you don't, you know, knock things off. And so, yeah.
But it's the same way you would treat your own house,
yeah,
essentially, you know, with a certain amount of care.
Is it fair to say, though, that if you go in without a proper plan, you might end up with heritage buildings that have been redeveloped beyond recognition?
Well, that's true as well. But if you don't go in with a proper plan, the other problem as well is not just that, is that you don't know what you're going to use it for. You know, quite often people say, oh, let's save this. You know, and then you go in and everybody works towards saving it, but to almost like,
what
and then how are you
going to
use it after that? And in the process of that, I think that engagement should engage the community that owns it, the community around it, because you want to make sure that, A, your neighbors don't get upset with you, when you're doing something, but also that you can mobilize, shall we say, you know, and socialize the ideas of why heritage is good, because other people will profit, so to speak, benefit from it. And if you look at World Heritage Listing, what it has done, maybe a bit extreme, you know, because everything's become commercialized on the one hand. On the other hand, it is the fact that people can continue to enjoy these aspects of the past. It doesn't mean that you can't change things. It means you change it with a sensitivity, I think.
Well, is it a problem for something to be commercialized? I mean, if that makes it easier to conserve buildings, if that makes it easier to conserve certain areas, certain heritage areas, is commercialization a problem?
No, not at all. But if it is done by, let's say, an outsider coming in with no understanding, you might actually damage the fabric and the community more than if you were to work, you know, holistically and collectively. So it really is the manner in which you approach it. Things have to, you know, be commercialized. I mean, in the sense of not so much commercialized, is they have to be sustainable, right? Then you have to decide, right? Is it that I want to make millions and millions of dollars off of it because that's my end game? Yeah, or is it because I want to make sure that it's sustained and retained so that my kids can enjoy it, or, you know, my community can continue to benefit from it? And it all depends on what exactly it is. So there are sort of different approaches for different levels of what you call, you know, the heritage values of that place. And by understanding those values, you then know the level at which you need to work toward this so-called commercialization. Yeah.
How is the success and value of heritage preservation judged?
I think that people, generally speaking, understand things as big and beautiful. If something is a beauty queen, you know, then it's seen as, oh, it must be kept, you know.
I also think a lot of people judge it by if it's the last thing standing.
Which is sad, right? Because then you only care about it once it's almost too late.
Because we get a lot of people coming in saying, hey, you know, we have to save this because it's the last thing there.
And probably by that time, it's too late, you know. But I think also that because heritage, until about, you know, 10 years ago, until actually, like, if you think about Georgetown and Malacca, there were the battles, so to speak, you know, with the developers, with the community, with the management, you know, and the authorities to actually retain these core zones for heritage purposes as World Heritage Sites, and to retain the character and the built environment and the intangible, that means all the people who lived there and the trades that went on there and the activities that went on there. To do that was a huge negotiation, and actually it was like, shophouse, lah, you know? It's like we have, you know, if we have 5,000 shophouses, why can't we get rid of all of them? But when you do that, or we just keep this block, you know? And it's like that becomes sort of a pastiche, yeah? So it's sort of the Disneyfication of things. You create this little theme park, you know, and say, let's come and enjoy this, you know? And it is very much a token. And without what Melanie was saying earlier about the respect that is due, because, you know, is that how we really consider our past, that we really, but we have no reference points. Once you get rid of something, you have no longer a reference point.
Well, Melanie, I mean, what are the challenges then of trying to communicate the importance of understanding this to people? Because you know, you talked earlier about doing your little explorations around KL, kind of wandering around, looking at things. How would you suggest we all go about kind of doing the same thing, examining our history, becoming more informed about who we are, why these things matter?
Well, personally, I feel like the first thing people should do is to actually go out and you see, like Badan Warisan, we do a lot of these different walks and things like that, and most of this content that we have is online. One of the first things to really understand where you are, where you live and where you work in, is to walk on the streets, you know, go to street levels and explore. A lot of the things that we do in Badan Warisan right now, we're trying to get our content online, so it's a lot more easier for people to access. I feel that quite a lot of young people especially don't know, probably, I don't know where to start or you know, how to get about things. And I feel like when we get all this information online, people can access it further and then go on these explorations to discover their cities. There's a lot of free things going on in KL that you can do to explore your city. So that would probably be the first thing to start on, you know.
Would you both say that there is strong public support for the conservation of heritage buildings here in our country? Or is it only when it's the last thing?
I think that there is
support at some levels, but I think that
also it depends on
the building itself. You know, something like I said, something that is beautiful, you know, beautiful need not necessarily be important, huh? But beautiful, you know, is seen as we must keep because it's a gem. But you know, historically important, that may be modest, you know, is not recognized. So it really is partly, I think, a mindset. I think there is much more of awareness. Certainly the media has helped. Social media has really helped, you know, promote that. But I think the understanding still remains relatively, you know, superficial. It's broader. It is slightly deeper. But maybe it needs to sort of grow more roots. And I think that, you know, what we've tried to do through the programs that we run is to just sort of say, hey, come in and learn something.
Join us, enjoy yourself.
Yeah. You know, and you go away saying, you know, oh, I got a little bit more knowledge in a fun way. You know, it doesn't have to be boring. Like, you know, it's not. And I think that what we also try to do is to provide things which are an alternative point of view. You know, it's not just what you learn in your school books. Yeah. It's kind of what you figured it out on your own, you know. And with some guidance as to what to look at. And when you look at something, to have a better understanding of it. I think in that way, that's what we try to achieve through our programming.
Government agencies exert a great deal of influence, you know, obviously through things like building permits, building regulations. One of Badan Warsan's aims is to influence policy so as to create a conservation-friendly environment. What work are you doing towards achieving that?
Well, that was sort of, you know, the almost the reason why we were set up, established in 1982, was because what was happening, especially in the capital city, was this sort of loss of the original old city centre, and the changes were really rapid, you know, in the development of the city. And Badan Warsan worked quietly and, you know, brokered, I think, various conversations with government agencies. We sit on committees, we do various things like that. But in these last, let's say, you know, 5 to 6 years, what we've also, 10 years, been doing is working with communities, much more with communities, and much more visibly with communities, I think, because communities can influence policy as well. And if people are aware, then people will want to protect. I mean, that at the end of the day is it. So we worked with the Ministry of Housing and Local Government to develop a law. And then that law, although it went into Parliament, was then taken over when they formed the Ministry of Culture and Heritage in 2003. I think the ministry was formed. Then they came up with the National Heritage Act, which was based on that. So all of that, you know, was a lot of the work that we did. But we sit, like I say, you know, on various committees. We sit on, and that's kind of like a bit boring, but, you know, but it needs to be done. It needs to be done because you know, you can at least influence decisions that are being made on the one hand. And then I think on the other hand, you know, doing the programming that we do, just bringing people to sort of say, oh, yeah, maybe, yeah, we should think about it a little bit more. We should think about before we demolish something, before we remove even a fence or a wall, what was that significance, you know?
Coming back to how fences and walls and buildings like that can shape our cityscape, famed Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas has said, we shouldn't tear down buildings we can still use. What are your thoughts on this?
From my point of view, I would say, indeed, because it costs money and energy and resources to put it together. If they can be used and adapted to new use, then surely that is a much more sustainable use of our assets, our
but
physical
assets.
Isn't
that assets? What we are teaching people also, though, how to use buildings, turn it in a different way? Yeah.
So, you know, like the Rumah Penghulu, I mean, it was a house. it was abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Number eight here in Street. It was a Dutch shop house, and now we turn it into a
visitor center. So. And the house that we're in was a residence, and people used to live there. It's now a heritage center, and so other people can use it. You know, it's used for activities, and so these are all adapted at not much. I mean, physical. You know, the fabric itself is the same. But its use is different. And I think the world changes as life goes on and as families change and as attitudes change. That's the kind of thing that you have to do. Adaptive reuse is key to the preservation of it doesn't mean that you can't build something new next to, but you might want to consider how large or how ominous or how dominating
that
new structure is in relation to what is there.
Aside from the visitor center examples that you cited, are there examples also of restored heritage buildings that are helping directly with local economies?
Apart from the World Heritage Sites, obviously mm-hmm. it's there. I think that if you look at the city of Kuala Lumpur, a lot of the buildings that have been retained are fairly monumental, and those ones that are monumental have got a very strong sort of tourist sense. They are beautiful photo ops, yeah. But they also give you a perspective. So imagine the Sultan Abdul Samad building and the Padang. And it was a British enclave where you had this group of really very quite inward-looking lords of the manor, so to speak, yeah. And everything they needed was around that field. And then next to it, across the river, were where the rakyat lived and different communities lived, the Malay communities, the Chinese communities, Indian communities lived and traded. And that contrast, as you see it, is actually really important. Now, imagine getting rid either of the British enclave or of the old part, you know, the shop houses and all of that. And if you got rid of one or the other, you don't have the contrast anymore. And your understanding of Kuala Lumpur and that development and the colonial history and administration is lost. So where cities or towns have retained them, sometimes by accident, sometimes because somebody has come along and said, hey, great tourist resource. Well, yeah, that's okay. You know, but Central Market, for example, was adapted because they couldn't keep the Central Market, a wholesale market in the middle of the city anymore. And that was adapted and it was moved, you know, to Selayang. But the building itself, you know, it retains, it's sort of its trading form, yeah, but it has new use because it's now commercial and touristy and, you know, whatever, but it still trades.
And still lovely.
And it's still lovely. Yes.
Skyscrapers can often determine a city skyline. You know, they're the things that when we think of iconic cities, sadly, that tends to be what we think of. These buildings, however, often belong to private investors. Where do you stand on the idea that hedge funds and super rich investors might have more influence on a city's atmosphere and overall look than the public sector?
Well, the public sector has a responsibility. The public sector, the agencies, have a responsibility to ensuring the urban landscape. And if they take that responsibility well and they take it fully, they will actually understand that there needs to be a balance. It doesn't mean no skyscrapers, because obviously skyscrapers are, you know, you're talking about modern technology, you know, and you're talking about parcels of land where you can build and the technology that enables you to do that. But it's a question of how do they sit cheek by jowl, or does one dominate the other? You know, and city planning is extremely important, which actually brings us to the talk that we're having this weekend, Shaping Kuala Lumpur. It's really a conversation between an architect and a planner about how Kuala Lumpur, from its its time as FT, when it became federal territory in 1974, you know, got shaped in the first 20 years of its existence. And what we see now is the relationship between the old and the new. Successful, not successful, you know, parts of it were successful and parts of it were not. And some of it was by accident and some of it was by plan. And then sometimes there was interference in a plan, you know, and that really is what the conversation is on Saturday.
And when is that?
At 10 o'clock on the 9th of April.
At Badan Warisan.
At Badan Warisan, yes.
What are some other projects in the pipeline for 2016 for Badan Warisan?
One of the few things that we're going to do is to actually do a little bit more of our heritage battles this year. We're going to do a fundraising project at the end. Toward the end of the year. But what we're really focusing on right now, because the past year or so, we've been doing a lot of the projects under our Cool City program. We've done walks, we've done talks, we've done the discovery walks and all that. For this year, we're trying to get more of our content online. So to get more video content. So people will have a lot more access to what we have, and hopefully this will engage them to come and join us in all the other advocacy work that we're planning to do this year.
And actually, we also run a lot of talks, and we host talks by other like-minded organizations. Yeah. So, you know, it's sort of quite a full program. Sometimes, like, oh, you know, you've had 4 weeks in a row, weekends in a row. The talks happen mainly at weekends because
KL
and traffic, and, you know, working, traffic jams.
Unfortunately, I didn't manage to make it to the Heritage Battle. I'm curious now, how did it go? Who won? You know, was it VI versus St. John's? What happened?
Well, it was actually a very fun battle.
I think on both, we did two battles. I mean, they battled it out twice with two different audiences.
Yeah.
VI won on both counts.
But I'm glad to see that, because when we do all these different activities, and a lot of people think like, oh, we're just doing boring talks, but this heritage battle, we saw a lot of young people there, which is a good thing. And it's a good thing for us because we're trying to do different things to get different groups of people to come, especially the younger ones. So it was a refreshing look to see school students actually coming in to support both Chaco and Dr. Zahim.
Yeah, I think that what we're thinking of doing is, because we did three discovery walks last year, we're planning three battles over the period of this year. They will all take slightly different models, but they will be in that form of, you know,
a battle,
you know, one against the other, sort of, you know, put you in a boxing ring kind of thing and see what turns out.
For more information on Badan Warisan and all the different activities that will be coming up this year, you can visit badanwarisanmalaysia.org. That's O-R-G. Thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Badan Warisan Malaysia's President Elizabeth Cardoza and Communications Manager Melanie Anthony, and we've been discussing Badan Warisan's work and what's in the pipeline for 2016. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.